Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Maggie Mullen.
And I'm Cooper McKim. Coming up on the program, lawmakers will soon be reviewing Wyoming's basket of goods with the hope that it could improve education and save money.
The only way right now in the state of Wyoming to save money in education is to fire teachers.
We'll also hear about one Wyoming city that's thinking about how a new winter tradition isn't only fun, but is a way to boost the economy over the slow season.
Now, when you have something to do in town, in the community, we can really start to expand out and attract people.
We'll also hear about the new self-sufficiency standard for Wyoming. Those stories and more here on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News.
Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Cooper McKim.
And I'm Maggie Mullen. Wyoming is looking to buy over 1 million acres of land across the southern part of the state. The deal hopes to diversify the state's investments, open previously inaccessible lands, and bring in new revenue for communities. But counties that hold the land wonder what downsides could come alongside those positives. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim reports.
Recently, state leaders in Wyoming announced an unprecedented land deal, one they're calling a potential deal of a lifetime. Speaker of the House Steve Harshman says it does pose major opportunities.
The potential then to provide some long-term benefit, not only to hunters, recreation, but really make this kind of our future corridor of development, of renewables, of our base industries, all those things that will probably be past our lifetime.
The land in question covers large swaths of southern Wyoming, covering much of the Red Desert. That region will be the site of major change, with the benefits as well as the potential downsides. Dave Davis is the assessor for Sweetwater County, the guy who counts tax dollars for the southwestern area, where a majority of the land sits that the state wants to buy. Off the bat, Davis wondered what this land deal could mean for property tax, because if Wyoming does buy it, Sweetwater County's land goes from a tax class that does pay money to one that doesn't.
The classification on that land changed from active to exempt if the state did own it. Then at that point, there would be a reduction in value in Sweetwater County.
Reduction in value as in at least $139,000 less per year in property tax revenue, money necessary for local services. That's because the land would go from agricultural status to tax exempt, as state-owned lands usually are. Davis says that loss isn't a ton, but
I'm the assessor, so we try and get every taxable dollar that we can.
And it's not just Sweetwater County. Lincoln, Albany, Uinta, and Carbon counties would all see a hit to their property tax revenue, totaling, at a minimum, about $222,000 per year for all of the counties. Laramie County also has property involved in the deal, but very little. The legislature is well aware of the issue and thinks it has a solution. Wyoming's House and Senate are considering bills to make sure counties get the money they expect, but not as a tax. Lawmakers are looking at something called a PILT, or payment in lieu of taxes, to fully replace that $222,000 per year. Tom Crank is a representative for Sweetwater, Uinta, and Lincoln counties. He says that PILT should be fine to make sure counties don't lose out financially.
The way it's written now, that there shouldn't be any implication, but everybody knows there will be.
Right now, federal governments pay counties a PILT on public land it manages, because the county would otherwise get tax money from it. Crank explains.
Counties are a little skeptical of just another PILT payment, so I think there's some reason to be a little hesitant.
Because PILT payments don't have a great reputation in Wyoming. Gillette Representative Scott Clem brought up reliability concerns for PILTs. He raised the issue on the House floor.
We all know that we're getting ripped off by the federal government because it's pennies in lieu of taxes is really what they're paying us. And so my concern is are we going to turn around and are we going to shortchange our counties? And I hope we wouldn't do that. But I guess the second thing is could we afford as a state to pay these counties if we were really being fair to them?
Lawmakers say mineral production should generate money right away on these lands. The bills, as written now, would just use that new revenue to immediately pay for the PILT that goes to counties, even above the rainy day fund. Lincoln County Commissioner Kent Connolly is very optimistic about the land purchase, but he says now would be a bad time to miss out on taxes.
We need to be kept whole. The taxpayers do not need to take a loss on this. The economy is, you know, struggling as it is right now, and so.
So Connolly says counties should have a seat at the table.
But absolutely, we are going to want to be involved. That's a standard bearer of what we do and how we try to approach things as county commissioners as a whole.
Speaker pro tempore Albert Summers tried to make that public input official for counties with land at stake.
You know, oftentimes we have hearings down here in the capital city, but I'd really like to see at least one meeting out in the country, out in where this land is. So
that amendment died, but the Senate has since passed a change to require public meetings. The House will once again consider public input. Rollins Senator Larry Hicks believes all this will get sorted out.
But I would guarantee you that everybody in this legislature is going to make sure that we hold the counties harmless of any tax implications associated with transferring from private to state ownership.
Chairman of the House Appropriations Committee says several other parties are seriously looking at the land purchase too. So the timeline to close the deal is quick. Occidental Petroleum wants it done as soon as this summer. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
Shifting to another issue at the Capitol, the Wyoming legislature will be undertaking what is called a recalibration of its school funding system. It's a process where lawmakers look at what they require of educators and if they are paying enough for education. But for the first time since it was developed, the committee will study what is in Wyoming's basket of goods. Those are the skills and content areas students are required to learn, such as math and science. Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck reports that while some are excited about possible tweaks, others are wary.
The idea of a basket of goods was developed following a major court case in the 90s that put in place the requirement for a state funding model for education. It's a system that determines how much money a school will receive. State Superintendent Jillian Balow says the time to review the basket is overdue.
So since the mid-1990s, we've added things to the basket. We've created more rigorous standards associated with the basket, but never examined the basket itself.
All experts agree that the basket does not reflect needs for the future. Wyoming School Boards Association Director Brian Farmer says updating it is tricky.
So how do we have this balance of equal educational opportunities, yet the flexibility to meet the needs of kids? I think that's the real challenge going forward, is creating a basket that can do both of those things.
Farmer says school board members are looking for a basket that considers educating students as well as getting them ready for the workforce.
Is there is a real interest in teaching kids those skills that are going to help them be 21st century ready? In some communities, that might be a very heavy interest in career technical education. So when you look at Shoshone, they built a brand new school, and that school was built with CTE in mind.
Farmer says the new model also needs to reflect such things as how districts might use technology. For Balow, it needs to have requirements, but also allow schools and classrooms to look into new and innovative ways of teaching. She says working in ways to use virtual education and higher education should be part of the mix. Wyoming Education Association President Kathy Vetter says she's both excited and nervous about the work ahead.
We have to get it right. This is the future for our students. These are our young people. We need to get it right. So there's that nervousness with it, because if we don't get it right, we're not going to do it again for 5 years.
Senate Minority Leader Chris Rothfuss doubts the focus will be on improving education.
I think that the reason that we're getting into the basket is to muck about and come up with reasons why we can cut funding and cut the quality of education, and it's not really a genuine effort to improve education in the state of Wyoming.
The reason why Rothfuss thinks this way is because lawmakers tried everything they could to reduce school funding through the last couple of recalibrations. Instead, they were told by consultants that they needed to add money, something they didn't do. Then in his State of the State message, Governor Gordon indicated that there might be a way to find savings by modernizing the basket. Rothfuss laughs at this.
The only way right now in the state of Wyoming to save money in education, truthfully, is to fire teachers. We've done a lot of work over the last few years trying to improve efficiency, and that's mostly what's left. So as we cut the block grant, we lose teachers. Class sizes go up. that's the natural outcome.
Rothfe says lawmakers have to fund education with taxes, plain and simple. Senate Education Chairman Hank Coe thought they'd have some new revenue by now.
The Revenue Committee tried. I know when Senator Peterson was here, they laid everything on the table and voted for nothing, absolutely nothing.
Coe says to talk about how to fund education every session gets old.
It does frustrate me a little bit. It's where are we going to be in 10 years? I mean,
start charging tuition.
That's not a bad idea. That's a pretty good comment.
Because you have nothing else.
We really don't.
Superintendent Balow says it's her task to focus the committee on making education the best it can be and deal with the cost later. Senator Rothfuss says good luck with that. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck in Cheyenne.
Stay tuned. Coming up, we'll hear about just how much money working families in Wyoming need to stay afloat. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Maggie Mullen.
And I'm Cooper McKim. The 2020 Self-Sufficiency Standard for Wyoming recently came out. It's a study that takes into account all kinds of factors for working families, like how many adults are in your household, the number of children, or which county you live in. And then it works like a calculator to determine the amount of income required to meet basic needs at a minimally adequate level. The idea is to provide this information to all kinds of decision makers, from lawmakers to nonprofits to businesses that want to set up shop in the state and need to know just how much to pay their workers. Wyoming Public Radio's Maggie Mullen sat down with Rebecca Smith and Alex Shannon from the Wyoming Women's Foundation to talk about their findings.
The thing that consistently stands out is that the cost of housing and childcare alone can make up about 50% of what you need to, or the monthly expenses at the bare minimum. Healthcare also is very expensive, and I think one of the most surprising things about this report is that we're able to look at what the history is over the last 15 years now, since it's been calculated four times in the last 15 years, and to see just the incredible rise in the cost of living in Wyoming was really surprising to me. I didn't realize that it had gone up that much, because I've lived in Wyoming for 20 years, and to see that that's happening in our communities is very concerning, and you know, just knowing that in some cases, the wages really aren't keeping up.
And it seems like really practical data. It's data that can be applied, you know, pretty immediately. And it reminds me, in lots of discussions with the wage gap, especially in Wyoming, part of it has been this idea that there's no credible data to have a conversation. Can you talk about how this study addresses that?
You know, it's one piece of the puzzle. It tells us what the cost of living is, and you know, the other piece is wages, right? And so what are the wages? And there aren't always great records on that in Wyoming, because it's not necessarily reported. But we have done some research, as well as the state has done some research on that. And so I think that it's just one piece of the puzzle that allows you to compare, when you do kind of know what the wages are in a community, compared to what they're actually able to get for those wages.
And Alex, how might this be different from something like the federal poverty guidelines?
One thing to keep in mind with the self-sufficiency standard versus other income benchmark standards that we're using, the self-sufficiency standard does vary by family type. We're actually up to 700 different compositions at this point that you can see all online. And then it also varies by geographic location. And so whether you're in Teton County versus Albany County, it's a big difference for the cost of living. And unfortunately, the federal poverty guideline doesn't take those into consideration. And so it is just typically measuring one factor, which is food. And it also has some outdated assumptions that there's only one provider in the household, which unfortunately takes healthcare out of the equation. And as we've heard, that's a big factor in the self-sufficiency standard.
That's another thing that struck me was, you know, just how thorough and how many different components, you know, there's just so many different combinations, and it seems like any one of those can really make a startling difference in how much you need to make to be self-sufficient.
Yes, absolutely. We found that a lot of the time when people are closing the gap with using those public and private assistants, that they are reducing the quality of childcare or the quality of housing, and that's not what we want. We want people to, you know, have proper healthcare and childcare and just get to a better self-sufficient place.
So, I mean, what's to be done? Is it as simple as raising wages?
I don't think that's ever simple. I don't think any solution like this is ever simple. I think one of the things that we're trying to do is provide resources to people that are already trying to work to help solve this problem. I mean, it's an ongoing problem everywhere in the world, everywhere in our country, in our state. And there are certainly people, there are nonprofits, there are agencies that are working to solve the problem of people not being able to meet a self-sufficient wage. So it kind of falls to all of us, you know, individuals, nonprofits, communities, to really help people get the training that they need to get those higher paying jobs, and then also take a look at what we can do in terms of policy to bring some of those wages up.
Well, thank you so much for sitting down and talking to me about the self-sufficiency report.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thank you. If you want more info, head to wywf.org. Thanks.
That was Rebecca Smith and Alex Shannon of the Wyoming Women's Foundation speaking with Wyoming Public Radio's Maggie Mullen.
Utah may be considered a ruby red state, but more than a quarter of Utahns actually vote blue. And of those Democratic voters, a small but growing number are young Mormons. The Mountain West News Bureau's Nate Hedgie explains.
It's a Monday night in Salt Lake City, and thousands of people are gathering to hear Democratic presidential nominee Pete Buttigieg speak at a convention hall downtown. Parker and Chloe Woods have just driven an hour and a half from the Northern University town of Logan, Utah to be here.
We have loved Mayor Pete ever since he announced his candidacy for presidency. Parker's
the Woods are both members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. But unlike a majority of their fellow Mormons, they lean left. And even though the church they attend every Sunday is against gay marriage, the Woods like Buttigieg, one of the first openly gay presidential candidates in U.S. history.
I feel like I can be a member of the church and also believe in a gay president, you know, so.
Parker's wife, Chloe, feels the same way.
It's like, it doesn't make any sense to me that, you know, Jesus would be discriminating against someone who's gay. I'm like, no, that feels crazy to me.
But unlike many religious groups in America, most Mormons keep politics to themselves.
I try not to talk about politics when I'm at church, just because I feel like everyone's going to disagree with me. So,
is that the same for you?
Absolutely, yeah. It's really sad. I wish that, I don't know, I just think, yeah, people are not very open-minded, I guess it goes back.
But the Woods aren't alone in their liberal beliefs. According to a 2016 Pew Research poll, the number of Democratic and independent Mormons in America has risen slightly over the past 25 years, while the number of Republicans has dipped. The church itself says it's nonpartisan and encourages its members to vote however they want. And it's worth noting that for years, Mormons were actually all over the board politically.
In fact, in the 19th century, they were seen as a radical group.
Patrick Mason is a professor of Mormon history and culture at Utah State University.
But in the 20th century, that all changed. And especially after World War II, Latter-day Saints, for the most part, gravitated towards conservatism and towards the Republican Party.
Mason says that shift really accelerated during the culture wars of the 60s and 70s.
They were especially worried about the removal of prayer from schools, about the issues of civil rights, and then feminism and gay rights, abortion. So the kinds of culture issues which have divided the right and left.
Those issues made Mormons some of the most reliably Republican voters in America. But nowadays, some younger Mormons are rejecting the culture wars that cemented the Republican leanings of many Christian groups, from evangelicals to the LDS Church.
And they're more interested in things like the environment and climate change and social justice issues.
But those older, more traditional church members?
They would see the Democratic Party as the party of gay rights, the party of abortion, the party of big government.
And that's a shame, according to Eric Biggert. He's co-chair of the Latter-day Saints Caucus for the Democratic Party in Utah. I meet him at a pizza shop near downtown Salt Lake. He says he can't understand how some traditional Mormons square their faith with a president like Donald Trump.
Can you be a member of the LDS Church in good standing, supporting a president who's had three separate marriages, two affairs, and children from multiple women, and unknown other intimate relationships with questionable people?
And at least one high-profile Republican Mormon just might agree with him. Senator Mitt Romney was the lone GOP member to vote yes on one impeachment article against President Trump. On the Senate floor, he gave an emotional speech, calling himself a profoundly religious person who had sworn an oath before God to exercise impartial justice.
You see, I support a great deal of what the president has done. I voted with him 80% of the time. But my promise before God to apply impartial justice required that I put my personal feelings and political biases aside.
For Eric Biggert with the LDS Democrats, Mitt Romney's stand is emblematic of how Utah and Mormon politics are unique.
Utah is not like any other red state in the entire nation. It's fundamentally a state that was founded by outcasts.
And now a new generation of outcasts may be moving in a new direction. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Nate Hedgie.
When we return, we'll hear about Sheridan's attempt to boost its slow season with a little winter rodeo fun. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Cooper McKim.
And I'm Maggie Mullen. The director of the Powell Economic Partnership is stepping down after 6 years at the helm. Christine Beckish was the first full-time director of the Economic Partnership and oversaw Powell's growing presence in the state. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska sat down with Beckish to reflect on her time in the position. Beckish said having a community development strategic plan completed just before she started made her understand what the community valued right from the beginning.
As we looked at what the community prioritized, things like manufacturing were a priority. A hotel, lodging, modern lodging was always a priority for the community, and it rose to the top again. Entrepreneurship. Definitely. And just business development in general. And those were ones that, you know, per the PEP board made the most sense for us to focus on.
And how did you go about that?
So that's where I got to come in a little more. So while we certainly worked for the community and the plan told us what the community's priorities were, the actual program development was something that I got to lead with my board. And so essentially just, I would say a lot of it was looking at best practices around the state and around the country and trying to see what might work best. They came out a couple different ways. There were some programs. We had one really fun program called Innovention that leveraged the makerspace and my county partners, Forward Cody, for example, the Business Council, Small Business Development Center, in some education for entrepreneurs. With the hotel and lodging, that one's different. But what I did was I ended up working with a private individual from Powell who was working on it. And once they decided that they weren't going to move forward with it, they donated their market study that they had personally paid for. They donated it to PEP. Yeah. And at that point, I'm able to have a broader community conversation. And that's what I did, brought the community and stakeholders together to listen to that conversation and to see if there was any interest in the community first, and also to understand how we might recruit a hotelier, a developer. So that was, you know, kind of one of our bigger projects. You know, in the manufacturing realm, I would say more than anything was getting to know our existing businesses. So just because I'm from Powell, I definitely didn't know them in this capacity. So a lot of it was relationship building. And I would say that's probably been the key to PEP's success and then mine as director. And that was really how we approached the manufacturing side. Because really getting to know our existing manufacturers or those that complement them is really important if you're going to support their growth. 80% of your jobs come from existing businesses. Or if you were going to talk to a company that was thinking about relocating here.
Just kind of looking bird's eye view at Powell, it's a small town in a small populated state. What were kind of the challenges from that?
I see Powell as so fortunate. So while we have challenges, I would consider us one of the luckiest communities in the state. And the reason being is we've had leadership that has prioritized economic and community development since before, you know, before I was an adult, for sure. It's why we have such a cute Main Street, right? Our city is well cared for. So from elected to just stakeholders. So Powell is very fortunate that we have a history of investing in ourselves. And so to move forward in a community like that is actually easy. Hmm. I can tell you it's easier than some of my partners around the state. Additionally, we have this incredible asset, Yellowstone Park, and we're only 70 miles from the park. That's one of the things since the merger with the visitor center and chamber is to really appreciate the assets of our community more. So there's challenges, workforce development, right? Well, guess what? Workforce is actually the topic of economic development across the country. So our labor challenges are the exact same. I think our opportunities are that we can move, we're agile, and we get things done.
How do you envision the community and PEP in the next year or two?
This year, before I knew I was going, I was telling my board in December, you know, we are just hitting our organizational stride. We have some incredible initiatives coming through that are really in the visitor economy side, definitely business and economic development. You hear it on the statewide scene, tourism. So we are a player in that as well, particularly with the new conference center. Powell will be one of the places to come in the state and to come for people outside of our state. We do have that statewide presence already that now it's more of a maintenance, maintaining those relationships. That this year we were going to, one, update our strategic plan. And out of that, likely roll out some pretty local initiatives and execute on some pretty local priorities.
When you reflect back, you've been talking about how you've created connections throughout the state. What do you think towns all over Wyoming can learn from Powell?
I think you can be really good at what you do, but if you're not connecting, you miss opportunities. In our state, we're too small. You go somewhere and you know half the room. We're too small not to have conversations because if somebody else is doing something and there's an opportunity to partner, you're just most of the time better off partnering. Why wouldn't you have something better and bigger? Or if you can learn from something they did and would do it differently because they've told you because you ran into them and talked about your initiative. So I think if I could tell the communities anything is to not be afraid to share and not be afraid to learn from each other, and also not be afraid to look outside our state.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Winter in Wyoming typically means a slowdown of visitors and tourism. But with the pressure of the state's dropping revenue, some communities are looking for ways to stabilize. Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler reports that one city realized how a new winter event isn't only fun, but helps to boost the economy.
On a cloudless February morning, Sheridan residents and visitors packed onto Broadway Street's sidewalks behind bright orange barricades that blocked a long ice path down the street. Skijorian horses, riders, and skiers lined up around the start line at the north end of the road.
You see the riding
to the second annual Wild Winter Rodeo. On behalf of the County of Sheridan and the Wild Rodeo Board, it's my pleasure to welcome you here today.
The first time the city hosted the Winter Rodeo and Skijorian race through downtown, they didn't know if people would show up, let alone if it would be a success. But it ended up bringing in an estimated 6,000 people on one of the historically worst weekends for tourism in the area. Sheridan Travel and Tourism Executive Director Sean Parker says this year's Winter Rodeo grew a lot because it was clear to him that after last year, the people wanted more. He says the event is doing what he intended it to do, changing the way people view Sheridan in the winter.
We've always been really known for outdoor recreation in the winter, but it's kind of limited to skiing and snowmobiling and cross-country skiing and those kind of things. So now when you have something to do in town, in the community, we can really start to expand out and attract people who maybe want to embrace Sheridan's culture, which is similar all year long, but then see something really, really cool.
After last year's winter rodeo, some local businesses reported historic revenue days in a time when they'd usually just be trying to get by. Luminous Brewhouse taproom manager Catherine Law says last year's event was the highest daily revenue Luminous has ever made.
January through March is known to be one of the slowest seasons, not only for craft breweries, but for businesses in general in Sheridan. And so for us, by the end of the month of February, it was equal to our normal paced months in the summer and in the fall.
Law says with the extra boost, they were able to tackle some to-do items at a time when they typically start penny-pinching. PO News and the Flagstaff Cafe is a couple of blocks away from the main action. Mark Demple owns and operates the business that's been around since the early 1900s. He says for a major event to come over the winter means a lot.
What we experienced last year, when we were looking over past years in February, we eclipsed our revenue numbers last year over previous years when there was nothing going on.
Dan McCoy is an associate lecturer in the Outdoor Recreation and Tourism Management degree at the University of Wyoming Hobbs School of Environment and Natural Resources. He says there's a tourism revenue drop-off over the winter in most communities throughout Wyoming, unless they're a major winter recreation destination, like Jackson.
Their tax revenue actually also drops off in the wintertime, just not as precipitously as some of the smaller communities who rely more heavily on summer tourism.
McCoy says that efforts, like the one in Sheridan, can reduce those peaks and pits and make revenue steadier year-round. But McCoy adds that success can't just happen overnight. It can take years to build crowds, and communities all together have to buy in to make the event successful.
Your local destination marketing organization can really help getting the community involved to offer a longer option so that there's multiple events on multiple days can really help move the needle. It also takes a lot of work and takes a lot of people from the community coming together to pull these things off, especially in the wintertime.
That community commitment is a big point for Tim Barnes, the co-founder of Blacktooth Brewing Company. Barnes says these winter revenue spikes just don't happen either. Businesses have to invest.
There's a lot of activity and revenue that's generated from it, but it's also predicated on the amount of effort and expense that's attributed to it as well.
In fact, in Sheridan, the building of a $50,000 Skijorian course is donated by a local concrete contractor. There are countless volunteers helping the day of the race, and still the city has to make some investments, like new safety barricades, budgeting nearly $12,000 for labor and equipment, and extra police. And beyond that, they have to come up with a plan to pay for it all. Those barricades can be used for other events, and grant funds are being used to pay for the police overtime. But Sean Parker with Travel and Tourism says they aren't done expanding the winter rodeo. Next year, they want to hold an outdoor hockey game north in Ranchester or Dayton.
We want everybody to share in this. And it does. It impacts everybody in the community but we want everybody to get a piece of this action.
And to keep expanding this new winter tradition, it will take even more planning and investment. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Catherine Wheeler in Sheridan.
The holy grail in the fight to stop climate change is reaching a bipartisan solution. To reach that end, the group Citizen Climate Lobby sent their regional director, Bill Barron, around Wyoming this month to engage in community conversation. At his stop in Laramie, Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards sat down with Barron to hear about the proposal his organization says is already drawing consensus from all sides.
The carbon fee and dividend is a proposal which is to place a gradually increasing fee on carbon emissions at the source, collect that money into a pool of money, and distribute the revenue back to households on an equal share. And then the third leg to our bill is to for us to have border carbon adjustments, where you're trying to protect manufacturers in the United States from manufacturers in other countries. So products coming into the United States, if the U.S. has a carbon price, we want to be sure that we protect the American manufacturers. So products coming into the U.S. would be assessed a border carbon adjustment, and then that would level the playing field between manufacturers in the U.S. and manufacturers in other countries.
Now, I wonder if you can kind of differentiate between what it is that you guys are proposing with the carbon fee and dividend and kind of what, you know, has been called a carbon tax. Is there a difference there, and can you kind of explain what that might be?
That's a great question. A carbon tax sometimes is seen as something that's regressive in that if it's a carbon tax, there's a price on the carbon emissions, but it doesn't mean that it gets returned to households. It's used in other ways. Where ours, if you work through the nuances on it, even though people will call it a carbon tax, it's not really a tax because we return all the revenue to households, which is a progressive way to address the issues. So all the money that we collect is given back to households, which...
Like it is to regular people?
Mm-hmm.
So, just a check could come in the mail.
Exactly. On a monthly basis, you'd receive a dividend, and it's calculated that 2/3 of households would do better or break even on the money that they receive in relation to their increased fuel costs. And it's distributed equally. So to clarify that, if you are... you live in a large house and you have your own airplane and a big car, or if you ride your bike to work and you have an apartment, that you actually get the same size dividend. So it's not as if you have an incentive to burn more fuel. And because the price is tied to the emissions only, we still adhere to a value of freedom of choice, which is really important with a lot of Americans, in that we're not dictating what choices they make and the fuel they use. It's just now there is a price signal that says that the cost of putting emissions into the atmosphere has a cost associated to it that's gradually increasing. Because it's a gradually increasing fee, there's an incentive for individuals to want to become more efficient, but it's not forced upon people. And the proposal has actually moved into becoming a specific bill that the Citizens Climate Lobby is focused on, and it's called the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act, H.R. 763, and it's in the House with 77 co-sponsors.
And how has that been received in general?
You know, we are really focused on having a bipartisan solution, and we're really excited that this is a bipartisan bill, and it has a lot of components to it that are geared to navigate the middle road between the right and the left. And we're really excited that we have 77 co-sponsors and that it's a bipartisan. It's weighed heavily on the Democratic side, but we also know that it's really important that this bill avoids becoming a political football, and how important it is to continue to work towards building support from the right and the left.
Yeah. You know, especially in a state like Wyoming, that we're sort of considered the energy basket of the country, you know, and you have been sort of making appearances around the state. What has been sort of your feedback? What are you hearing from folks around Wyoming in terms of this idea?
So I started on a tour. I began in Cody and Powell, and then went on to Sheridan, Gillette, now here, and then I'll be heading to Lander. And what I found is there's an appetite and an interest in working towards a bipartisan approach to addressing a problem like this. Certainly, it's difficult in Wyoming because of the way the economics are structured for the state. But the decline that is being seen, for instance, in the coal industry is something that's happening anyway as consumer preferences change, and that the technology that's been tied to the advancements in fracking for natural gas has really had an effect on that. And I think that there's an interest in the citizens of Wyoming to look further down the road and still be an exporter of energy potentially, but in areas such as wind and solar and possibly geothermal, where Wyoming can still be an exporter of energy, but look towards energy sources that are more favorable for our climate.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards discussing the carbon fee and dividend option with Bill Barron, regional director of the Citizen Climate Lobby, to see the bill his group is proposing or to find out about participating in one of the many action teams. Visit our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Maggie Mullen.
And I'm Cooper McKim. Members of Wyoming's arts community gathered last Friday to honor the five recipients of the Governor's Arts Awards. One of those honorees was visual artist Robert Martinez. Wyoming Public Radio's Savannah Marr sat down with him this week to talk about his work and what the award means to him.
When I arrive at his studio outside of Riverton, Robert Martinez is doing some detail work on a painting of a buffalo. It's huge, it's charging straight at the viewer, and it's painted in vibrant sunset colors.
Yeah, this is a darker shade of alizarin crimson with some doxazine purple mixed in. And what I'm doing is I'm just putting it on the painting where I need it to go in general. Then I'll take a different brush and smooth it out.
These bright, contrasting tones are Martinez's signature, and he says he paints in this style for a reason.
You see many depictions of natives as black and white or sepia toned, and that connotates to a dead culture. So one of the things I was doing with this bright paint was to show that we're not dead, we're alive and strong, and wanted to grab the attention of the viewer.
Martinez is Northern Arapaho and Chicano. He grew up on the Wind River Reservation in a family of artists, and he likes to disrupt people's ideas of what Native art should look like. Another way he does that is by combining images we associate with the Old West with pop culture elements, like taking that stoic, sepia-toned Native man and putting him in a Run-DMC shirt. Martinez shows me one of his recent pieces, drawn in Plains Indian ledger art style, but with a contemporary twist.
It's on a Wyoming map, a vintage Wyoming map. And it features three Native men kind of squatting, looking around a giant mid-80s boombox, and they're all wearing tracksuits, but you can clearly see they're Native. It's one of those elements that I use, a piece of technology or the way they're dressed, and mix the past and the present, the modern and the classical.
These days, making and selling art is Martinez's day job.
Currently it is. For a lot of years it wasn't, though. So for a lot of years I had another job working for my tribe or working for a school system.
He says a lot of the reason it took so long to build a sustainable business around his work is because of where he lives.
So in the central Wyoming area, art's not valued at all. In the northern plains in general also, Native artwork is not as valued as it is in the Southwest. So Northern Plains artists such as myself don't seem to have as lucrative a career as somebody that may be in Santa Fe.
Another problem, he says, is that the market is saturated with non-Native artists whose work aligns more closely with cliches and stereotypes. Martinez's art is all about challenging and complicating the public's idea of what Native people and Native life are like, and not all buyers and collectors are interested in that.
Well, one of the things being a contemporary Native artist you come across is adjusting expectations of what is actual Native art and who Native people are. But people want to see the romanticized ideal. They're not usually ready to see the actual ideal, especially when it comes to paintings with issues or communicating something about what's going on today. But along with that becomes educating collectors.
So learning how to market his work to collectors around the country and build a client base has been a challenge for Martinez. Now that he's learned those lessons for himself, he spends a lot of time guiding other Native artists. He's a co-founder of the Northern Arapaho Artists Collective, a sort of mentorship group where Arapaho artists help each other navigate the wider arts community. But Martinez also wants his art to be accessible locally.
So I know that art can get pricey. Not everybody can afford a $10,000 painting. So I also put some of my images on t-shirts or tote bags, cell phone cases, stuff that everybody can afford.
Martinez found out in the fall that he'd been nominated for a Governor's Arts Award. He says he got the call that he'd been chosen in December while he was driving.
Usually if you get a call on your phone in your car, you just keep rolling. But I figured since it was the governor, I better pull over to the side of the road and be serious about it.
Typically, he says awards and accolades aren't too important to him. He measures his success in other ways, like how many other artists' careers he's helped to launch. But this one is special because it's recognition coming from his home state.
It's the highest award that Wyoming can give. And there have only been a few. I only count three or four. People of color on that awards list. So I'm happy to be one of them and hope to see more in the future.
And his next project is going to stay right here in Wyoming. That giant red and orange buffalo he's working on is part of a triptych of paintings that will soon be on display at the Buffalo Bill Center of the West. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Savannah Marr on the Wind River Reservation.
A Pinedale artist has a new show on display that was inspired by roadkill. Christy Onspaw has spent the last 2.5 years making ceramic jars to honor each animal killed on her route between Boulder and Pinedale. Over the course of 8 months, she made 110 jars. Onspaw talked to Wyoming Public Radio's Megan Feary.
It always bothers me the amount of animals hit on the highway between my house and town. And I thought about making art about that, and it seemed kind of grim and dark. But I was kind of rolling that around in my head, and then an event happened where I was driving out of town with my daughter in the car. She was maybe 13 at the time, and a lady hit a deer. I stopped to help her because parts of her car were all over the road, and she was having trouble dialing her cell phone because she was shaking. And so I was assisting this other driver, and I didn't realize that I had parked the car with the headlights illuminating this slowly dying two-point buck. And Megan, she had to just sit there and watch this little deer die over the course of about 20 minutes. It bothered her, and we talked about it a lot. She is a rugged Wyoming kid. She has hunted and harvested animals for food, but the part that bugged her the most is the disrespect that we show to them, you know, that we just don't even seem to think about it very much. And I never thought about it from that angle before. You know, kids see things differently. We kind of maybe get a little bit jaded. And so we talked a lot about what would it look like to respect the deer that we hit. So I started making these jars.
So you call them jars. Do you think that they could also be seen as urns?
I'm leaning away from the word urn. I don't know. To me, an urn is just a very specific type of an object. And I was just thinking of these as lidded vessels that could go on to be something else in somebody's life and maybe hold coffee or sugar on the counter and not seem strange, but also be made in honor of an animal's life.
So you don't see them as symbols of death?
Maybe just sort of like a little memorial.
And how did you keep track of how many jars you needed to make?
At first, I thought I was going to have to try to pay attention and count and try to watch, but I realized that wasn't going to work because sometimes you don't see them or they get picked up or you're out of town for a while. And I learned that the highway department keeps track, and then it all goes into a database that can be accessed. So I was able to get, and this is what I've recorded on the jars, is the species of the animal and its relative age, like if it's juvenile or adult, and the date and the mile marker. So those things are all recorded on each jar. And then there's a drawing, and they're all different, but as specific as I could to, oh, okay, this is, you know, a juvenile whitetail, and this is an adult pronghorn. So they're all a little bit different, and I just explore different techniques of addressing that surface. And the project got really big really fast, and I thought, well, that's, I think, maybe even more reason why I need to do it. So I kept making jars.
Ultimately, what do you want people who view your work, your art, to come away with?
Well, I hope they think it's beautiful. I do. It's turned out much, much prettier than I thought it would be. And that's kind of strange, which is not a very pretty topic, but it's interesting how it's very appealing, but it's also a little bit, maybe a lot, surprising of the quantity.
Was this project initially meant to raise awareness, or was it more personal for you?
Yeah, for me, it was very much a personal thing. How can I pay respect? You know, how can I maybe make an apology? And yeah, and also from a personal point of view, I think I can honor all of these deer over this winter.
Do you think that people become desensitized to seeing roadkill?
Absolutely. I think we develop calluses on our heart. But as a community, we care about our wildlife.
What's been the overall response to your pieces?
So much more traction has happened than I expected. Yeah, a lot of really positive. And I'm happy about that, too, because one of my very favorite places is the overlap of art and science. Artists and scientists think so much alike, and it's a process of, I wonder about this, and then I research about this, and then I try this, and then that didn't work, and I take another run at it. It's been great to work with biologists, and it's been great to have the interest of people who maybe don't know a lot about contemporary art, but really are interested in animals. That's a fun combination of people.
Now, do you feel that your project is finished, or is there more you'd like to say?
I think there's still a lot to be said. I mean, when I started this unintended consequences thing, I was thinking a lot about roadkill. And as I have moved through it, I'm learning that the real story is migration. So that's where my focus is looking now.
Christy Anspaw, I want to thank you so much for speaking with me.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Open Spaces. If you missed something or want to hear something over again, you can do that at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Just click on Open Spaces.
Also, never miss an episode by signing up for our podcast on that website or wherever you get your podcasts. Also, be sure to rate it. Anna Rader is our web editor.
Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.